And the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Gorsuch has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-175, City of Grants Pass versus Johnson.
According to the federal government, homelessness has reached its highest levels since it began reporting data. Why people become homeless is complex and often beyond their control. Economic conditions, domestic violence, and mental health and drug addiction sometimes play a role. Doubtless, other causes play a role too. With the rise of homelessness, the federal government reports that there are today more homeless encampments in this country than there have been in nearly a century. Often these encampments are found in a city's poorest and most vulnerable neighborhoods. Cities tell us that these encampments have contributed to a rise in crime against both the homeless and other local residents, crimes including sexual assaults and shootings. Communities of all sizes are grappling with how best to address challenges like these. Many charitable organizations offer emergency shelter. Many state and local governments are working to increase affordable housing. Many, too, have reinvested in mental health and substance abuse treatment programs. Some states and cities have chosen to pair these efforts with the enforcement of laws restricting camping on public property. Laws like these are found in communities across the country. The federal government likewise restricts encampments on its parklands. These public camping laws are not without their critics. Some say they do more harm than good. But many cities report that they do not deploy these laws as a frontline response. Instead, they say public camping laws are an important secondary tool, one they use to address particular encampments that pose significant health and safety risks, and to encourage those who are homeless to accept safer alternatives like shelters, drug treatment programs, and mental health facilities. Public camping laws, many cities say, are just one tool in the toolbox, but one they need to tackle the homelessness crisis in their communities. 5 years ago, in a case called Martin versus Boise, the Ninth Circuit held that the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishments barred the city from enforcing its public camping ordinances. Neither before nor after Martin has any other circuit in the country followed the Ninth Circuit's view of the cruel and unusual punishments clause. But inside the Ninth Circuit, as one of our lower court colleagues put it, if you pick up a map and point at a city, there's a good chance that city has already faced a judicial injunction forbidding it from enforcing its camping laws. Today's case involves one such injunction against the city of Grants Pass, Oregon. The city, like many others, has deployed multiple strategies to address homelessness. A liaison officer coordinates with the city's shelter to support local homeless communities. The city instructs its police officers that homelessness is not a crime and encourages them to render aid to the homeless whenever possible. The city also has public camping laws on the books, but relying on Martin, the Ninth Circuit enjoined their enforcement. Cities across the Ninth Circuit, from Anchorage to Phoenix, Honolulu to Las Vegas, urge us to take this case to review the Ninth Circuit's course since Martin. Organizations representing thousands of other cities, counties, and public officials called for our review as well. They tell us that while Martin was well-intentioned, it has made their jobs harder. Harder because most of their offers of shelter and assistance now go rejected by homeless individuals, many of whom cite Martin as their justification to permanently occupy public spaces. Meanwhile, these cities say shelter beds sit empty. Grants Pass's own local shelter reports exactly that experience in the wake of the injunction against the city. We agree to take this case to consider whether the Ninth Circuit was correct in holding that the Eighth Amendment prohibits the enforcement of public camping laws. As our opinion explains, The Constitution does impose many limits on what governments may declare to be criminal. The First Amendment prohibits governments from enforcing laws targeting speech. The Equal Protection Clause prevents the enforcement of laws that discriminate invidiously. The Due Process Clause guarantees a fair trial in a fair tribunal. One could go on. But the Eighth Amendment serves a different purpose. It does not address what conduct a state may declare unlawful. Instead, it concerns what happens after a criminal conviction. In prohibiting cruel and unusual punishments, it focuses on the kind of punishment a government may impose, not on what behavior it may criminalize in the first place. The text and history of the clause has long supported that understanding. So has this court's precedence, with one exception. In a case called Robinson versus California, this court in 1962 faced an unusual California law that made being a drug addict a crime. The court held that the Eighth Amendment does not permit a government to make a person's mere status criminal. It would have been a different case, the court stressed, if California had made it unlawful for anyone, even an addict, to use drugs. But California had not done that. And in focusing on status rather than actions, the court held, the state had crossed a line. Indeed, California's status-based law was so unusual that the court had not encountered one like it before, nor has it since. More than a half century after Robinson, the Ninth Circuit suggested for the first time that public camping laws cross the line we drew in Robinson. That assessment was mistaken. Through much of the nation's history, cities across the country have prescribed, as Grants Pass does, the act of public camping. They do not criminalize the status of being homeless. In this respect, public camping laws are nothing like the unusual law at issue in Robinson that made the status of being an addict a crime. Instead, they are exactly like the law Robinson said California could have pursued, making criminal the act of using drugs, even by an addict. The plaintiffs before us essentially acknowledge all this. So rather than apply Robinson, they ask us to extend Robinson. They argue that we should hold that the Eighth Amendment bans laws focused on acts that are in some sense involuntary. Put another way, they argue that public camping laws may address acts rather than status, but they make unlawful acts that homeless people cannot help but undertake. Put another way still, they say public camping laws may not directly target status, but they effectively do so. The trouble is, this court has already considered whether to extend Robinson in this way and rejected it long ago in a case called Powell versus Texas. There, Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote that the court had no authority under the Eighth Amendment to go beyond Robinson and forbid states and cities from regulating acts that might in some sense flow from a status. So yes, the court said, a state may punish the act of using drugs even by addicts, and it may punish public drunkenness even by alcoholics. As Powell put it, a state may regulate acts even if they are impelled by a status the defendant cannot easily alter. Justice Marshall drew this firm line because the Eighth Amendment's text, again, focuses only on punishments after criminal convictions, and it provides, as he put it, quote, no limiting principle that would serve to prevent this court from becoming the ultimate arbiter of the standards of criminal responsibility throughout the country. Unaided by anything in the Eighth Amendment, Justice Marshall said, judges would be left to write into the Constitution their own formulas and proceed by fiat, his words. Not only does Justice Marshall's precedent in Powell control us here, his warnings speak wisely too. Consider just a few of the questions the Ninth Circuit has had to confront since Martin. Under Martin, cities must allow public camping by those who are involuntarily homeless. But how are city officials to know what it means to be involuntarily homeless, or whether any particular person meets that standard? Posing the questions may be easy, but answering them has proven not to be. Is it enough that a homeless person has turned down an offer of shelter, or does it matter why? Cities routinely confront individuals who decline offers of shelter for any number of reasons. How are cities to know which are sufficiently weighty to qualify a person as involuntarily homeless? To be sure, the Ninth Circuit in Martin sought to head off these complexities through a formula of its own creation. The Ninth Circuit said that a city must consider individuals involuntarily homeless and thus entitled to camp on public property whenever the city's homeless population exceeds the number of adequate shelter beds. But city officials report that it is all but impossible for them to maintain an accurate accounting of their homeless populations on any given day. In Los Angeles, for instance, officials tell us it takes 3 days to count the homeless population block by block, and that with the participation of thousands of volunteers. Beyond those complexities lie others. Suppose cities could keep a running tally of their homeless citizens, and suppose they could keep a live inventory of available shelter beds. Even so, cities face questions over which shelter beds count as adequate under Martin. Is a shelter bed adequate for a smoker if the shelter requires residents to abstain from smoking? Is a bed adequate for an atheist if the shelter includes religious messaging? Different courts in the Ninth Circuit have answered these very questions in very different ways. There are more problems still. The Ninth Circuit held that involuntarily homeless individuals cannot be punished for camping with materials necessary to protect themselves from the elements. But how far does that go? Some judges in the Ninth Circuit have suggested that cities need allow only blankets on public property. That is the view the plaintiffs in the case before us propose. But other judges and other plaintiffs have suggested and indeed held that permanent encampments, campfires, and much more must be tolerated too. The Ninth Circuit's experience since Martin illustrates what Justice Marshall knew. Nothing in the Eighth Amendment's Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause provides easy answers to difficult questions like these. Nor does it give federal judges the power to impose their own views on cities across the country. To answer hard questions like these, judges must, as Justice Marshall put it, write their own formulas into the Eighth Amendment. Despite all this, the plaintiffs today ask us to nationalize the Ninth Circuit's Martin experiment and usher federal courts into the role of setting homelessness policy nationwide. To do otherwise, they warn, would leave the homeless without any meaningful legal protections. We reject that view. Our decision today concerns only the scope of one specific clause of the Eighth Amendment. Many other provisions of the Constitution exist to protect the homeless and all Americans, including the due process guarantee against selective prosecutions and the Equal Protection Clause's requirement demanding that all citizens be treated equally before the law. Other legal protections exist, too. Many jurisdictions recognize a necessity defense to charges of public camping. And nothing prevents cities or states from taking their public camping laws off the books altogether. Indeed, after this suit began, Oregon itself amended its laws to narrow the authority of state cities, like Grants Pass, to regulate public camping. The cities before us know well the seriousness of the homeless crisis. But many also report that Martin has only made matters worse. Almost 200 years ago, a visitor to this country marveled at the energy and civic engagement of the American people. And if the multitude of briefs from cities and states across the country in this case prove one thing, it is the American people are trying to bring that same energy and skill to bear in efforts to address homelessness that face the most vulnerable among us. A handful of federal judges cannot begin to match their collective wisdom. And while the Eighth Amendment serves many important functions, it does not authorize federal judges to take from the American people the right and the responsibility to dictate the nation's homelessness policy. The judgment of the Ninth Circuit is reversed. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion. Justice Sotomayor has filed a dissenting opinion for herself. Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson.
Sleep is a biological necessity, not a crime. For some people, sleeping outside is their only option. The city of Grants Pass jails and fines those people for sleeping anywhere in public at any time, including in their cars, if they use as little as a blanket to keep warm or a rolled-up shirt as a pillow. For people with no access to shelter, that punishes them for being homeless. That is unconscionable and unconstitutional under the dictates of Robinson. Homelessness is a reality for so many Americans. On any given night, over 500,000 people across the country lack shelter. They experience homelessness, as you were told, due to complex and interconnected issues, including crippling debt and stagnant wages, domestic and sexual abuse, physical and psychiatric disabilities, and rising housing costs coupled with declining affordable housing options. At the same time, states and cities face immense challenges in responding to homelessness. It is possible to acknowledge and balance the issues facing local governments, the humanity and dignity of homeless people, and our constitutional principles. Instead, the majority focuses almost exclusively on the needs of local governments and leaves the most vulnerable in our society with an impossible choice. Either stay awake, be arrested, or leave the city. The case boils down to one legal question. Do the ordinances in Grants Pass criminalize the status of being homeless? That was answered by Robinson, but the majority says no. But every shred of evidence points the other way. Start with their purpose. The Grants Pass City Council decided to target homeless people with these ordinances, and the City Council president proclaimed that the point is to make it uncomfortable enough in our city so they will want to move on down the road. The council even discussing making do not serve lists for the homeless or the most unwanted lists. This was not a last resort. Next, consider the text. The ordinances by their terms single out people without shelter. They define campsite as any place where bedding material is placed for the purpose of maintaining a temporary place to live. So the conduct becomes criminal only if a person lacks a place to live. Infant snapping in strollers or nighttime stargazers all engage in the same conduct of bringing blankets to public spaces and sleeping. But they have a separate place to live. Because they are not homeless, their conduct is not criminalized. Finally, the ordinances are enforced exactly as intended. The majority claims that it makes no difference, in its opinion, whether the charged defendant is homeless. That describes a fantasy. In reality, the deputy chief of police testified that he was not aware of any non-homeless person ever getting a ticket for illegal camping in Grants Pass. The majority does not contest any of this. Now, the majority can list difficult questions about when shelter is needed, available, and adequate. But that does not resolve this court or it of the responsibility to interpret and enforce the substantive bounds of the Constitution. The majority shifts the goalposts and focuses on questions beyond the scope of this case. It's talking about encampments and fires and other issues that are not at issue in this case. This sleight of hand allows the majority to abdicate its responsibility to answer the Eighth Amendment question in this case by framing it as a policy question. Generally, however, federal courts are in the business of providing answers when needed to interpret and enforce the Constitution. As the majority notes, people experiencing homelessness may still have other legal protections, including under state law, the excessive fines clause, and the due process clause. Moreover, nothing in today's decision prevents local governments from declining to criminalize people for sleeping in public. Nevertheless, Every person in this room, like every homeless person, needs to sleep. This court has clearly held in Robinson that the Constitution prohibits punishing someone's status. Therefore, the Constitution prohibits punishing the very existence of people who lack shelter. Look at the statistics in Grants Pass. It has a fraction of the beds necessary to house the homeless, and it doesn't even provide it. A charity provides a limited number of beds and then conditions their use temporarily on issues that many homeless cannot take advantage of. It doesn't it does not permit the homeless to bring medicines they may need. It requires those who are disabled to work a full week. And it requires religious service. Not just does it provide religious materials, it requires its residents, who may be an atheist or something else, to attend. So it should be no surprise in Grants Pass that its beds are not filled. For someone with no available shelter, the only way to comply with the ordinances in Grants Pass is not to sleep or to leave the city altogether. The Constitution provides a baseline of rights for all Americans, rich and poor, housed and unhoused, criminalizing involuntary conduct and conduct that many people cannot control. This court has an obligation to safeguard the rights of those people, even when, and perhaps especially, when doing so is uncomfortable or unpopular. I remain hopeful that someday in the near future, this court will play its role in safeguarding constitutional liberties for the most vulnerable among us. Because the court today abdicates that role, I, with Justices Kagan and Jackson, respectfully dissent.
I have the opinion of the court in case 22-451, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, and 22-1218, Relentless versus the Department of Commerce. In these cases, two groups of Atlantic herring fishermen have challenged a rule issued by the National Marine Fisheries Service. For an agency to issue such a rule, it must have authorization in a statute passed by Congress. The statute the service relied on here authorizes it to require fishermen to make space on their vessels for federal observers who monitor the catch and collect data. It also identifies three specific categories of fishermen responsible for bearing costs associated with observers. But the small family-owned businesses that fish for herring in the Atlantic are not among those groups. In 2020, though, the service nonetheless issued a rule requiring Atlantic herring fishermen to pay for the required observers. The service estimated at the time that the costs could reduce returns to vessel owners by as much as 20%. The fishermen each sued the service, arguing that the statute does not authorize the service to require them to pay observer costs. The question before us is not whether the fishermen are right. It is instead how courts are supposed to decide cases like these, in which an agency's interpretation of a statute is at issue. You might expect courts to simply say what the best interpretation of the statute is. But one of our decisions, Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, requires something quite different. Under Chevron, a court must decide first whether the statute is ambiguous. If the court decides that the law is clear and unambiguous, it can go ahead and say what the best reading of the statute is. But if the court thinks the statute is ambiguous, there is a second step. The dispositive question then becomes whether the agency's interpretation is a permissible one. If a court thinks it is, and they usually do, the court must follow what the agency says, even if it thinks another interpretation is better. Returning to the fishermen who brought these cases, each of the courts below, applying Chevron's two-step framework, rejected their challenges. The fishermen then sought our review, asking us to revisit our decision in Chevron, and we agreed to do so. We start from first principles. The framers of our Constitution assigned to the courts, not the political branches, the responsibility and power to say what the law is, as Chief Justice Marshall famously put it in Marbury against Madison. And they expected courts to do so by applying their own independent judgment. Indeed, they designed the Constitution to shield that judgment from the influence of the political branches. From Marbury on, the court repeatedly emphasized its duty to exercise independent judgment in interpreting the laws passed by Congress. The court maintained that the views of the executive branch warranted respect and could supply important guidance, but could not bind a court. And the court reaffirmed that understanding even through the New Deal era, when new agencies with new powers proliferated. In 1946, Congress codified these basic principles in the Administrative Procedure Act. That law, known as the APA for short, says that a court reviewing agency action, quote, shall decide all relevant questions of law, end quote, interpret constitutional and statutory provisions, end quote. That language means what it says. Courts, not agencies, must decide all relevant questions of law when reviewing agency action. And although the APA tells courts to defer to agencies on other matters, it does not tell them to defer to agencies on questions of law. If Congress wanted courts to do so, in a break with more than a century of consistent practice, it needed to and would have said so, but it did not. For four decades after the APA's enactment, courts continued to follow the traditional understanding. But then, in 1984, we decided Chevron, which triggered a marked departure from that approach. Remember, Chevron's two-step framework requires a court to defer to an agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute if that interpretation is permissible, even if the court thinks there is a better reading. Chevron is inconsistent with the APA. Chevron says that if a statute is ambiguous, a supposedly permissible agency reading must prevail over what a court determines is the best reading of a statute. Put more simply, Chevron tells courts that in some cases, rather than file their own judgment, they must instead ignore it and follow the agency's instead. The APA says otherwise. The government's principal response is that under Chevron, courts correctly presume that by leaving ambiguity in statutes, Congress implicitly delegates discretionary authority to resolve them to agencies. The problem is that the presumption makes little sense. Congress knows how to delegate discretionary authority to agencies. To take one common example, statutes often empower agencies to regulate as reasonable or appropriate. And when Congress has actually delegated discretionary authority to an agency, a court's job under the APA is to say so and give effect to Congress's choice. But a mere statutory ambiguity is not itself such a delegation. A statute might be ambiguous for any number of reasons. After all, courts often encounter statutory ambiguities in cases having nothing to do with agencies. In those cases, courts understand that no matter how impenetrable the statute may appear, there is a best reading, and their job is to say what that reading is. None of that changes just because an agency enters the picture. It would be especially inappropriate, in fact, for a court to simply go with what an agency says when the question involves, as Chevron cases typically do, the scope of the agency's own power. The government counters that Congress must intend for agencies to resolve ambiguities because agencies are subject matter experts. But courts, not agencies, are the experts in interpreting statutes, including technical ones. And in agency cases in particular, courts may seek guidance, as they often have, from the informed judgment of the executive branch. So giving agencies the final interpretive authority, as Chevron effectively does, is just not necessary to ensure that interpretation is informed by relevant subject matter expertise. The government also argues that Chevron's presumption makes sense because resolving ambiguities really involves policymaking. Policymaking is, of course, the responsibility of the political branches, not us judges. But every day, courts resolve statutory ambiguities by engaging in legal interpretation, not imposing individual policy preferences. So Chevron does not prevent judges from making policy. It prevents them from judging. To try to fix Chevron's flaws, we have spent decades adding various preconditions and exceptions to the doctrine. to avoid the complicated doctrinal breakdance that Chevron has become as a result, courts often simply decline to apply it. We are guilty of that ourselves. We have not deferred to an agency under Chevron since 2016. In short, Chevron is both wrong and increasingly irrelevant. But that conclusion does not end our analysis. We must still determine whether the doctrine of stare decisis, Latin for let the decision stand, requires us to keep adhering to Chevron anyway. It does not. Chevron was a fundamentally misguided decision. It reshaped judicial review of agency action without even mentioning the APA. And it has confounded the litigants and courts that have had to apply it. Nobody seems to know how much ambiguity in a statute is enough to trigger Chevron's second step, or even when ambiguity exists in the first place. That means that results under Chevron are arbitrary and unpredictable, and it is also unpredictable whether a court will even invoke Chevron or instead try to avoid it. Chevron also destroys reliance interests. Its logic is that a statutory ambiguity is a license for the agency to change positions as much as it likes. By allowing agencies to change course even when Congress has given them no power to do so, Chevron leaves those attempting to plan around agency action in a fog of uncertainty. Stare decisis does not require us to stick with a misguided, unworkable, and harmful decision. The time has come to leave it behind. Chevron is overruled. But that does not mean that past cases that relied on Chevron must go, too. We do not dispense with statutory precedents just because we have changed how we decide cases. Going forward, though, courts must exercise independent judgment in deciding whether agencies have acted within their statutory authority as the APA requires. They cannot let the executive branch say what the law is just because the law is ambiguous. Because the courts of appeals for the D.C. Circuit and the First Circuit were bound to apply Chevron rather than simply interpret the statute before them, their judgments are vacated, and the cases are remanded for further proceedings consistent with our opinion. Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch have filed concurring opinions. Justice Kagan has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson join. Justice Jackson did not participate in the D.C. Circuit case, case number 22-451.
With respect, I dissent today for myself, for Justice Sotomayor, and for Justice Jackson in one of these cases. Today, the court rejects a doctrine of judicial restraint and judicial humility, not just once, but twice. The court does so first by eliminating Chevron deference, the doctrine that when a regulatory statute contains an ambiguity or gap, the agency Congress has charged with administering the statute should usually have primary say over its meaning. The court does so second by abandoning stare decisis, the doctrine that, barring special reasons, courts should stick to their prior decisions. Both of those doctrines, in different ways, tell judges that they do not know everything, that they would do well to attend to the views of others. Today's court will have none of that. In overruling a 40-year-old precedent, the majority hands courts power over all modern governance, pushing agencies to the side. Courts, and in particular this court, will now play a commanding role in the nation's policies, about to name only a few: the environment, healthcare, the financial system, and new technologies. Chevron has served for decades as a cornerstone of administrative law, allocating responsibility for statutory construction between courts and agencies. Under Chevron, a court uses all its normal interpretive tools to determine whether Congress has spoken to an issue. If the court finds Congress has done so, that is the end of the matter. Congress is the nation's lawgiver, so the agency's views make no difference. But if the court finds at the end of all its interpretive work that Congress has left a gap or an ambiguity, that Congress has not provided direction, what then? Some actor has to resolve the ambiguity or fill the gap. Should that actor be a court, or should that actor be the agency that Congress put in charge of the statute? That's the issue Congress addressed. It's a who decides issue, the responsible agency or a court. And what Chevron said was that the decider should generally be the agency. The court would still have a role. It would make sure that the agency selected a reasonable construction of the statute from among the alternatives. But beyond that, a court should allow the agency to take the laboring oar. Why? The first cut answer Chevron gives is because that's the way Congress would want it. And Congress gets to decide. Nothing in the majority opinion today calls that into question. The problem is that Congress usually doesn't say which actor it would prefer in the event it's left uncertainty. So Chevron established a presumption, a default rule, based on the best and most realistic understanding of what Congress would want. It would want the agency. But then the next question is, again, why? Here I think it helps to get concrete and ask, what do these interpretive questions look like, really? That will tell us whether Congress would expect the agency responsible for the statute to do the work, or whether Congress would instead want a court. The dissent has quite a number of examples, but I'll just give two here. The first will focus on the agency's expertise and experience in regulating a particular area, and the second focuses on the agency's role in policymaking. Number one. Congress told the Fish and Wildlife Service to list endangered species, including distinct population segments of some species. A question then arose. Is the Washington state population of western gray squirrels a distinct population segment because it's geographically separated from other western gray squirrels? Or does that population need to be different in other ways as well? Now, we could look up the word distinct in the dictionary as a court would, but it wouldn't help. Deciding when one squirrel population is distinct from another really requires knowing about species and species populations. What someone is going to have to figure out is how much variation of what kind, geographic, genetic, behavioral, and so forth, will make the statute work in the way Congress intended. And that someone should be the agency, because agencies have expertise in, know things about, a statute subject matter that courts don't. It's the Wildlife Service, not any court, that knows about biological species and their population segments. And agencies also are intimately familiar with their own regulatory programs in a way courts aren't. So, for example, people within the Wildlife Service will know about how the term distinct population segment has been applied to Arctic graylings and desert eagles. But again, not courts. So if to resolve a statutory ambiguity, you need subject matter expertise and regulatory experience, as you very often do, you give the matter to an agency. And Congress knows that. It was Congress that gave responsibility for species listings to the Wildlife Service in the first place, for just that reason. Example number two is Chevron itself, and it concerns a different kind of ambiguity or gap. Not one that requires a lot of expertise and experience to sensibly resolve, but one that necessitates simple policymaking, of a kind courts are singularly unsuited for. The question in Chevron was about how to define the term stationary source when it was used as a stationary source of emissions. Should the Environmental Protection Agency use a more stringent definition of that term, which would better curb air pollution? Or should it use a less stringent definition, which would better promote economic growth? Once again, Congress simply didn't say. Both understandings were fully consistent with the statutory language and with other signals of statutory meaning. To resolve that issue, and many Chevron questions are of this kind, someone needs to make a policy trade-off between competing goods and values. Should a court make a trade-off like that? Cleaner air versus more economic growth? Or should it be an agency, which Congress has entrusted to administer the statute, which Congress continues to have real influence over, and which also reports to a president who in turn answers to the American people? Chevron said Congress would want the politically connected and accountable agency, not the intentionally detached and unaccountable court, to be making that kind of sheer policy choice. And what we've learned in the last 40 years is that Chevron was right in everything it said about what Congress would want and why. because Congress has always been able to reject Chevron deference, whether across the board or as to a particular subject matter. But it basically never has. Congress has chosen to leave Chevron as is for decades. That's the best sign there is that Congress wants an expert, experienced, politically accountable agency to resolve ambiguities and fill gaps in the statute that Congress made the agency responsible for. But today, the court replaces agencies with courts. It gives courts control over matters they know nothing about, some of the most technical and scientific kind. It gives courts controls over policy issues, often concerning cost-benefit assessments and trade-offs among conflicting goods. It puts courts at the apex of the administrative process as to every conceivable subject. What actions can be taken to address climate change or other environmental challenges? What will the nation's healthcare system or its financial system look like in the coming decades? What rules are going to constrain the development of artificial intelligence? In every sphere of current or future federal regulation, expect courts, and in particular this court, from now on to play a leading role. Courts, which do not know a lot about these issues and which have no business making the nation's policy choices. The majority defends this breathtaking change as one suddenly required by the 80-year-old Administrative Procedure Act. But the APA makes no such demand. The relevant statutory language says that courts must decide all relevant questions of law. That language does not specify the standard of review that courts should use in doing so. A court could decide a question of law by starting from scratch, as the majority insists today. We call that de novo review. But a court can also decide a question of law by evaluating whether the agency's reading is reasonable, as Chevron instructs. In other words, a court can use deferential review. The APA is agnostic on that issue. It allows either one. And that's the way almost all administrative law experts of the time understood the language. The majority's view of this 80-year-old statute is a new one. The majority gets no more support from the history of judicial review. The most relevant time period here is right before the APA was enacted. That's because, as this court has many times said, and the majority concedes, the APA was supposed to reflect, not change, existing law. And the law at the time was highly deferential to agency statutory constructions. When faced with an ambiguity or a gap, courts often asked only whether the agency's reading was reasonable, just as Chevron instructs. So if the APA did not change the law, which it did not, or was supposed to have not, then the APA did not prohibit a deference rule. In short, today's decision is not one the APA directs. It is the majority's choice to put courts in charge of business that agencies have done for decades with Congress's full knowledge and consent. And the majority could not do what it's done today without abandoning stare decisis. That doctrine is a core feature of the rule of law because it enables people to order their lives in reliance on judicial decisions. And Chevron is far more than one decision by this point. Congress has passed statute after statute with the expectation that Chevron would govern. Agencies have issued rule after rule on the understanding that statutory ambiguities were theirs to resolve. Courts have upheld those rules under Chevron on thousands of occasions. And private parties have in turn ordered their affairs around all those agency actions and judicial rulings. Reversing Chevron threatens to cause a massive shock to the system. And for what? Stare decisis is also supposed to act as a brake on the urge to convert every new judge's opinion into a new legal rule. It requires that a court have a special justification, usually involving large-scale changes in the law, in order to reverse a precedent. It's not supposed to be enough that new judges have new views about the worth of regulatory agencies or their work. But the court has nothing much else to offer today. Its justification comes down in the end to this. Courts need to have more say over regulation, over the provision of healthcare, the protection of the environment, the safety of consumer products, the efficacy of the financial system, and so on and so on. Courts, the majority says, need to roll back agency authority and to take for themselves the decisions agencies make. A settled precedent at the crux of modern governance thus yields to a bold assertion of judicial power. Once again, with respect, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Jackson, and I dissent.
I have the opinion of the court in case 235572, Fisher versus United States. This case is about the indictment of petitioner Joseph Fisher for his actions on January 6, 2021. On that day, while Congress met to certify the votes of the 2020 presidential election, a crowd of supporters of then-President Donald Trump gathered outside the Capitol. Some people forced their way into the building, breaking windows and assaulting police officers. The certification of the vote was delayed as a result. Fisher is alleged to have been among those who invaded the Capitol. Fisher was charged in an indictment with various crimes. The only one that concerns us today is a charge that he violated 18 U.S.C. Section 1512C2. Now, Section 1512C has two subsections. Subsection C1 imposes criminal liability on anyone who corruptly, quote, alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so, with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding. Subsection C2 extends that prohibition to anyone who otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. Now, the question is whether C2 should be read as a freestanding provision, making it a crime to obstruct an official proceeding by any means, so long as the conduct is not already covered by C1. Under this reading, someone could be prosecuted under C2 for obstructing a proceeding by burning down the building where it was being held or blockading the roads leading to the building. Or should C2 be read in light of its connection to C1? C1 prohibits particular ways of impairing records, documents, or other objects used in a proceeding. C2 may be read as covering additional ways of interfering with the evidence in a proceeding, for example, by forging evidence. C2 could also extend the prohibited interference with evidence beyond records, documents, or objects to things such as witness testimony. Maybe Congress wanted to criminalize all conduct that obstructs an official proceeding in Section 1512C, gave a few examples in C1, and left the rest to be swept up by C2. This all-encompassing interpretation of C2 is what the government asks us to adopt. But C2 could have a narrower reach if Congress designed it to fill any gaps that might exist in C1. Today, we reject the government's sweeping interpretation of C2. We hold that C2 does not cover every other way that a person might obstruct an official proceeding. It instead closes whatever gaps there might be in C1. Our conclusion follows two principles of statutory interpretation. First, the canon of nocitor associus says that a word is given more precise content by its neighbors. And the canon of justum generis teaches that a general term is often defined by looking at the specific examples that come before it. Consider an everyday example. A zoo might post a sign that reads, "Do not pet, feed, or throw objects at the animals or otherwise disturb them." Now, if a visitor eats lunch in front of a gorilla or talks to a friend near its enclosure, has he obeyed the rule? Of course. The specific examples of impermissible conduct are all about direct harassment of the animals. Merely eating or talking is so unlike the petting, feeding, or throwing objects at an animal that it would be implausible to assume that they were prohibited. The same basic idea applies to Section 1512C. Subsection C1 includes many specific examples of prohibited actions that have the intent to impair an object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding. The most sensible way to read the statute is that those examples help define the scope of C2. And if we ignored those examples and read C2 as broadly as the government asks, C2 would swallow C1, leaving nothing for that narrow provision to do. it makes sense to read C2 as limited by C1 in light of the statutory history. Congress enacted this statute in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to address a particular problem. In an earlier form, the statute made it a crime to persuade another person to shred documents, but curiously failed to punish a person for destroying records himself. The Enron scandal revealed that loophole. Even though Enron's auditor had destroyed documents, prosecutors had to prove that higher-ups convinced someone else to shred them. So Section 1512C was passed to plug this gap. It would be odd to conclude that in doing so, Congress actually created a catch-all that reaches far beyond the document-shredding scenarios that prompted the legislation. Reading subsection C2 as a freestanding provision, not limited by C1, would also make many other anti-obstruction provisions in the federal code unnecessary. And it would erase the fine distinctions Congress drew among different types of obstructive conduct in Section 1512. That section prohibits nearly 24 means of committing obstruction, with penalties ranging from 3 years to life in prison. Now, if C2 covered essentially all obstruction, many offenses that Congress assigned proportionate penalties to would all fall under the 20-year maximum in Section C2. Even stranger, an unlimited reading of C2 would impose decades in prison for conduct like protesting and lobbying. Now, our usual practice in obstruction cases has been to avoid reading provisions like C2 to create a cover-all statute. There's no reason to depart from that approach today. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is vacated, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with our opinion. On remand, the Court of Appeals may assess the sufficiency of Fisher's indictment in light of our interpretation of Section 1512C2. Justice Jackson has filed a concurrence. Justice Barrett has filed a dissent, joined by Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan. This court will next sit Monday morning at 10 o'clock. At that time, we will announce all remaining opinions ready during this term of the court.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.